From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
The subtitle of Ellen Ecker Ogden's latest book, The New Heirloom Garden, tells it all. Designs, recipes, and heirloom plants for cooks who love to garden is how it reads. Throughout her career of writing and lecturing and teaching about kitchen gardening, Ellen always reminds us it's not just the literal harvest and what we can cook up from it, but also the opportunity for beauty and for intimate engagement that the vegetable garden can offer. More in a moment, but first, these messages.
Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. Brushwoodnursery.com. Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com.
Ellen Ecker Ogden, with several books on food and gardens to her credit, was co-founder of the breakthrough seed catalog called The Cook's Garden, which introduced U.S. gardeners to a whole new palette of possibilities that back then were more familiar perhaps in Europe, but not here. She lives in gardens in Vermont, and I'm glad she's back today. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Margaret.
How's your snowbank?
It's drifting.
Oh, okay.
It's high. It's quite high.
Yeah, I should say before we get started that with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com, we'll have a book giveaway of the new book, which is very beautiful. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
It's
definitely it's a treat to hold the book after so many years of working on it.
Yes. I remember visiting your Vermont home years ago and looking out the window of your house onto your own edible garden. And I can still remember because it struck me so much. It was as beautiful as any ornamental garden. And a lot of us, myself included, don't manage that and grow our edibles in sort of, you know, regimental rows and blocks and not much design involved. But you want to encourage us to go further, don't you?
Well, it's true. And I guess I hadn't realized how different I garden than some other people. But I have a small plot. It's less than a quarter acre. And so pretty much every inch of it was planned with what I call my five-year plan. And that included the parterre garden to the south of the house. And it's right up snug to the house, so I can get into it very easily and look at it from the upstairs windows.
Yes. And so it's a parterre, it's a four square, is that what we call that?
Yes. It's a European style, very classic design with really it's small. It's quite small, but I managed to grow quite a lot in that small space.
Yeah. So the word heirloom in the title of the new book, The New Heirloom Garden, it's a word that has many definitions and interpretations. But I think by that, in this case, you're not really defining a particular time period in history as much as sort of what you say. You write that these are varieties, the ones that you showcase in the book and the various garden designs that you have plans for. You say there are varieties that are not associated with large-scale commercial agriculture. Yes?
Right. Well, I'll start off by telling you a little bit about how I started to write the book, because as a writer yourself, you know that you don't, unless you're writing a novel, you don't really know how it's going to evolve. And the seed for this book really was planted in 2016 when Garden Design Magazine called me and asked me to design a couple of heirloom gardens for an issue they were doing. And at the time, I kind of knew what an heirloom was, but I really wasn't sure. So I called Amy Goldman, who had just done a beautiful book called Heirloom Harvest, and I asked her. And then it kind of took off from there. I suddenly became quite fascinated by heirlooms and what is an heirloom and what is the difference between an heirloom and an open pollinated. And it just kind of snowballed a little bit and became a book proposal and eventually a book. But it started from my not really knowing myself what heirloom is.
Right. And so for people who don't know, even less than we knew back then when that phone call came, all heirlooms are open pollinated. They have to be that. They're not hybrids.
Yes.
Yeah. But people disagree on what the number of years they've had to be, existing for and so forth. And so we don't have to go into that, but just so that it's not heirloom or open pollinated, all heirlooms, whatever age they are open pollinated.
Are open pollinated, right. And that's what Amy explained to me. And she used the date roughly 1950 before hybrids were introduced to gardeners and garden catalogs. But I actually went to the dictionary, the Merriam Dictionary, and the definition says heir, which means inheritance, and loom, which means tool. So it was a way to pass along something valuable without a money exchange or paperwork. And so
right.
I thought that was a wonderful definition of heirloom.
Right. And in the new book, I think very smartly, you have these kind of pages every so often that are like interviews with seed people who are seed savers and collectors and so forth, who are involved in this work, and they're obviously alive today since you interviewed them, and they are creating, a lot of them who are seed breeders and so forth, they're creating modern heirlooms of the future. So in other words, the timing doesn't, the age doesn't matter, except in the classical definition like Amy Goldman shared with you. There's also going to be heirlooms, 100 years from now or 50 years from now, some that are being developed right now, open pollinated varieties, by some of the people you interviewed in the book. So.
Yes, that's right. I like to say grow something new that is old, but we're not talking about old seeds. We're just talking about a new way of really embracing some of these older vintage varieties, heritage varieties. And actually, the interviews in the book were my favorite part because I came up with all the designs and I came up with all the recipes, but I realized there were some missing pieces there because I was still learning. I've been gardening for 30 years, and I still feel like I can learn something new every day and
right.
feel so humble that there's so much to learn. And so I interviewed people like Will Bonsall, who has the Scatter Seed Project, and his message about seed saving was about diversity. And Roz Creasy, who, we all know her as the pioneer of edible landscape design, and she said flavor is the most important thing. And so I found that there were so many different perspectives on an heirloom garden, and mine was just, it was mostly kind of like Roz's. I garden for flavor and for fragrance, but also because I love the idea of being able to save my seeds and pass them along to other gardeners.
Right. And there's, I think, 12 themed gardens in the book. You offer designs to scale with plant lists that are coded to go in each part of the grid and so forth. And they're very different. And one of them is, in fact, themed as a seed saver's garden. I believe. So that could be a focus, a theme, whatever your design is, whether someone decides to use the one in your book, or you can also establish a theme for the garden to come. There's one, I think, the Italian, one about Italian vegetables, and I mean, all kinds of wonderful themes, vegetables that have richness of color. So tell us about a couple, just kind of the range of design ideas.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hesitated putting designs in here because people to use it like a recipe book, and that it's just a way to inspire ideas, and hopefully gardeners will look at it and really spring off into their own creative way of how they're going to design a garden that fits into their landscape. But some of the designs, some of my favorite, for instance, is the Arc of Taste Garden, which is based on the slow food endangered list of plants, varieties that are maybe lost if we don't start preserving them. And then the new American Heirloom Garden, which is based on Thomas Jefferson's garden, and what would he do? And I was able to interview Peter Hatch, and he gave me this wonderful historical perspective on whether he thought Thomas Jefferson would appreciate what he would think of GMO seeds, for instance. And, you know, they were just really fun. So I think a lot of the theme gardens were really inspired by just getting to interview gardeners from all over the country and right. getting their ideas.
Well, and you must have had fun kind of dreaming because, you know, visualizing, and this is the time of year that we're at right now, you know, we're in February and in the Northeast, especially where both of us live, but in a lot of the country, it's still not time yet. And so there's a lot of conceiving and dreaming and imagining. And so what I took away from it, because I have the same raised bed grid, you know, out in my yard of for edibles that I've had, I don't know, for 30-something years since I got here. So it is what it is. I'm probably not going to, at this stage, redesign and exactly. But I looked at all the different garden designs in your book, and I thought, ooh, wait a minute. There's even elements here that could make my layout more beautiful as well as more productive. So I wanted to sort of talk about some, you know, that we could take away whatever our design is that sort of elevate the aesthetic. Like, I mean, a lot of the pictures had vertical elements, you know, tripods and tours, towers of vining things and certain mm-hmm. plants that you specify, you spec out on the edges of other things, which I just visually, I was thinking, ooh, that would look gorgeous next to my tomatoes or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I do, and that's so great because it's exactly what I want you to take away from the book, and which is why I started as an art major. I was an art history and a fine arts major, and I've tried to translate that into my garden and my garden designs in both of my books. And so I really feel that starting with a design on paper and then figuring out how visually it's going to look is interesting, because so many vegetables are ground huggers, and it's much nicer to be able to grow them up on a trellis. It adds drama and height to the garden as well as texture. I mean, the plants, like the purple Triumpho de Violetto purple pole bean, is just the most elegant plant that I grow in my garden, and I could see it in perennial gardens. I could see it, you know, growing over the front porch. There are just so many ways to grow vegetables, and they don't have to be relegated to the vegetable garden.
What are some of the things that we could, those of us who are a little more regimented and boring, that we could dress up sort of the edges? Because there's always some space, you know, at the along the edges. And I mean, sometimes I'll put lettuce on the shady side in the summer, or parsley, mm-hmm. or any other ideas. You use flowers also a lot more liberally.
Yes. Well, I think that was one of the hardest things to do in the book, because being from Vermont, we have a fairly limited growing season. So I wanted this book to be accessible to gardeners all over the United States. So I needed to figure out what could grow in the South, what could grow in the West, you know, not just things that I knew well, but things that perhaps I'd like to try if I were growing in other places. So there's a wide range of plants. And again, suggestions, mostly suggestions in the garden. But for instance, melons. I've never really been able to grow melons here, but the Moon and the Stars watermelon and the Jenny Lind cantaloupe are two that I've always wanted to try, and I must confess I try them every year, but they never quite fruit. But things like artichokes, I've learned, I can grow, and I grow them every year. I start them in March and put them out in April, and I usually have gorgeous little buds in mid-July.
And they're beautiful plants, really. I mean, they're structural, I guess I would say. Is that what I want to say? Structural plants?
Yeah, I mean, they're really fun to watch if you don't pick them, which I often don't, because I like to just let them go to purple flower. And so, again, that's a wonderful example of putting an edible plant in your perennial border.
Right.
Something like peas. Peas are just the most beautiful. Peas and beans are my favorite plants, mostly because I love vines. I'm kind of obsessed by growing vines all over the place, and I love the way that some of the old heirloom varieties, like the Lincoln, will just grow so tall that telephone, there's one called telephone pole, which grows to be about 10 or 12 feet tall.
Right.
And they're just really fun to grow. I guess what I mostly want to convey in the book is that growing food should be fun, and to turn ways to turn work into play by designing a garden and then just mixing and matching colors and flowers and textures and fragrance, and of course putting a bench in the garden is very important because you need to take time to sit and observe and listen and taste and all of these things that really are the reason we garden. But sometimes we forget that gardening is all about opening the senses.
And, of course, the only drawback of the bench is that sometimes all those delicious peas never make it into the house.
Because
I sit there eating all of them.
That's true.
Right?
That's where you sit down and you eat those alpine strawberries because they're not supposed to make it into the house. They're supposed to be eaten right in the garden.
So I wanted to talk about some of the varieties you love, and you've mentioned a few already, but before we start on that, we should just say, wow, this is a crazy time for gardeners, and especially for seed ordering gardeners who might want to grow edibles because, whoa, everything is, it's not sold out as in there is none. It's that it's not in packets. They've exhausted the seed that was already packed up in the warehouses and they have to restock. And it's hard to do that safely during COVID with, you know, too many employees in the same space at the same time. So anyway, you know, it's so there's great delays in getting seed, but because you have always loved unusual things and old varieties and so on, you've often had to hunt things down. So this maybe doesn't feel, you know, it's been a challenging pursuit. Maybe this doesn't feel so different for you, this sort of treasure hunt kind of thing that we're all going through right now.
Well, I haven't experienced delay. I save most of my seeds, so I grow them again or I get them from other seed savers. There's a wonderful Seed Savers Exchange annual book that I pore over. It's about 500 pages long, and you can get seeds from seed growers all over the country. You don't have to be dependent on seed catalogs. And so you're right, I'm not really dependent on seed catalogs, but of course I'm like any other gardener. I love to dream a little bit and try something. But I do have my favorites, my favorite catalogs, and usually they're the smaller regional catalogs where I know where and how they're growing the seeds rather than if they're just buying them from some commercial grower.
Sure. It was funny when I saw the seed catalog list in the book, I thought, oh, that's identical to mine. So great minds think alike.
Well, it might have even come from you, Margaret.
I never know. But it is.
You know,
I love the
we get our best. I always say we get our best ideas from other gardeners. So,
yes.
And you are certainly one of my favorite gardeners.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very sweet. So one of the garden designs in the book that got me thinking is called the Herbs, Greens, and Aromatics Garden, Wild and Cultivated Salads. And I suspect that salad bowls on the table at Ellen Ogden's house are a little more interesting, sort of both visually and flavor-wise, looking at this garden design, than for a lot of us, like colorful beet greens and chervil. And tell us about some of the things that we, without a lot of difficulty, could make a little room for and sort of spice it up and make it more beautiful in the salad bowl.
Oh, well, I love this question. When we first started the Cook's Garden catalog back in 1984, we really just focused on lettuce and salad greens because our garden was zone 3 and it was the only thing we could successfully grow without losing it to frost. And so we imported a lot of Italian salad greens and French greens and did have wonderful salads. And I still feel it's the number one thing that I will always plant in my garden are lettuce and salad greens. So there's chervil, claytonia, purslane, the golden purslane that actually grows upright instead of hugging the ground.
Oh.
I grow a lot of the lettuces from the Wild Garden Seeds catalog. I just love their mixes. And, you know, mesclun really just means miscellaneous greens, and it's what the peasants harvested for centuries, and it's sort of ironic that we're now paying $9 a pound for it and it tastes like nothing
yes.
in the grocery store.
Yes.
But it's still, I think, the healthiest and the easiest crop to grow for all gardeners.
And so you all along with that, you also have, like, I mean, we both love bull's blood beet, and anyone who hasn't tried that and has the energy to hunt down some seeds. That's a great one, I think, with these beautiful like wine colored leaves that are wonderful as baby beet greens and really dress up a salad bowl, I think, for instance.
Right. And McGregor's beet greens are grown really just for the tops, not the roots, which is another good one. And it's kind of a perennial. Oh. So when you cut it, comes again. It's a cut and come again.
So McGregor's as well as bull's blood. Okay. And then there were some sort of edible flowers in there. I think you had borage. Is that right? Borage?
I don't have the garden. I don't have it open in front of me, but I do love borage. Borage is kind of a large plant, so you really only need one or two, but it's such a wonderful pollinator plant. I grow lots of different nasturtiums. I'd probably grow about 20 different kinds of nasturtiums. I have what I call my 80-20 rule, which is 80% tried and true, the things I'm always going to grow each year, and then 20% new and different that I will experiment with each year.
Oh.
And so one year I grew lots of different nasturtiums. Of course, I wasn't very good at keeping the tags in place, so I have no idea which ones were which, but it was fun.
What about mosh? I saw that, and I saw some cresses in the list, too. I have to say I haven't really grown cress a lot or mosh a lot. Tell me a little bit about those.
Oh, cress. Well, Wild Garden Seeds has this wrinkled, crinkled cress, which is kind of hot and tangy. And it's to me, it's better than arugula. Arugula is a little bit bitter, but cress is hot like a mustard, but it's got little tiny leaves like a parsley. So a little bit goes a long way in the salad bowl. And you sow it, and probably 10 days later, you're harvesting it. And it's just, you know, a fabulously healthy, delicious green. And mosh is a little trickier. It's a European green, or at least I see it in Europe year-round in the farmer's market when I've been there. And it's a cool weather crop, so it loves early spring and it loves late fall. And it has spoon-shaped leaves that have a slightly nutty flavor. And again, it's mostly about the texture and the color and the way it looks in the salad bowl as much as the flavor.
Huh. I forgot to ask with the purslane, and you said you grow this golden one that's a little more upright. Do you, is it like, do you just pinch off what you want from day to day, or how do you, is that, or just harvest it all at once? I mean, I've never grown it for that purpose. I've only grown it in my driveway, Ellen.
Well, that's good, too. You know, purslane is one of those neglected weeds that I think we should all embrace. It doesn't have a lot of flavor, but it's very high in omega-3. The golden purslane looks like the regular purslane. It looks more like a jade plant. It grows upright, and it has that kind of succulent leaf. And if you cut it right above a leaf nodule, it'll keep growing. It's not a hugely vigorous plant, but it's a nice plant to add to the salad bowl. When I grow mesclun, I grow things in individual rows and then mix them together in the salad bowl rather than do a mixed packet, because in a mixed packet, they often grow at different times.
Right.
And so, you know, you're going to get your arugula and your mustard, but then the mosh and the slower things like the purslane are going to take a lot longer.
Okay. So in the last couple of minutes that we have left, I just want to give a nod to the fact that, like the seed company you co-founded was called The Cook's Garden, like the subheading of this book explains, you know, it's for cooks who love to garden and so forth. That's a theme, and you've studied cooking and so on. And the back section of this book is recipes. And I loved how when you tell, like for your bread and butter pickles, which by the way looks like a great and very simple recipe, you specify you'd like us to use Boston pickling cucumbers, I think, right? Like you have favorites, right?
Well, I needed to tie in my first of all, thank you for noticing the recipes. I still consider myself more of a cook than a gardener. And, of course, the two go hand in hand when you're growing food. But in the recipes, I specify heirloom varieties that you can use because I consider a lot of the heirloom varieties to have the better flavor. And so those Boston cucumbers are better pickling cucumbers, I think, than just sort of a generic old pickling cucumber. But, you know, who's to say? Flavor is such a personal thing. But when we had the Cook's Garden, we always had tasting weekends where we would have people come and taste our beans and all the tomatoes and carrots and even the parsley we found. We'd have 12 different kinds of parsley, and we found that there was always one that was a favorite. And it's very much like the Italian sagras, you know, getting together with people and tasting food and talking about the flavor of food. It's just such an important piece that I wish there were more opportunities to do.
Well, I really am enjoying the new book, The New Heirloom Garden. Ellen Ecker Ogden, thank you so much for making time today. And as I said, we'll have a book giveaway with a transcript of the show on awaytogarden.com. And I hope I'll talk to you soon. And I know I'm going to be growing some different things this year if I can find the seeds.
I'll send you seed, Margaret. Thank you so much. It's such a delight to talk to you. And I look forward to hearing more about your garden.
Okay. Thank you.
Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com. Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. BrushwoodNursery.com.
And thanks to all the rest of you for listening. Don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher, iTunes, or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy seed chopping and gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.